Father Michael Drum is our next speaker. Father Michael Drum, I know quite well, because I'm a lecturer now in Matter Day Institute of Education, as David Quinn told you, mainly in moral theology. And Michael Drum was the director of the Institute when I began in 2002 to be a lecturer there. So he basically gave me my job. So you'll know from that he's a man of very high, very sharp intelligence and judgment. Michael is always very interesting to listen to, and the last few years he's been involved in the Catholic Schools Partnership, and you'd have seen him on the telly and heard him on the radio, I'm sure, on several occasions, particularly, I suppose, focusing on the issue of education at the primary level, and in light of the forum on patronage and pluralism. So Michael is very much up to date, very informed on all the various happenings, and will no doubt tell you more about those. So I'm delighted to welcome him, and he'll speak for about 25 minutes, half an hour, and after that then we'll have a chance before we finish for some more questions and answers. So give a warm welcome, please, to Father Michael Drum.
So thank you, John, for the kind introduction. Bishop Clark, ladies and gentlemen, I'm glad to be here with you today. I might preface my remarks by acknowledging the important role I think that the Iona Institute has played in recent years in this whole debate, and thanks to David Quinn. One of the reasons I think why the contribution of the Institute is so welcome is that it's both intelligent and informed in an area where intelligence and information can sometimes be lacking. So I think that has been an important part of the contribution made by the Institute thus far, and long may continue. In April 2011, the Minister for Education and Skills established a forum on patronage and pluralism in the primary sector, and the advisory group overseeing that forum issued a preliminary report in November last, 2011, and their final report is now awaited. The Minister and the Chairman of the Advisory Group, Professor Coulihan, have made clear that what they are attempting to achieve in this process is not a complete restructuring of the primary school sector in the Republic of Ireland, but greater diversity of school provision in a more pluralist society. And so the key word in this whole discussion really is pluralism. The Minister says that his aim is not to impose a secular agenda on schools, but to ensure that the system is responsive to parental demand, so that school provision actually matches the religious and sociological realities in our local communities on the ground. It was clear, I think, and this should be acknowledged, I was a full participant in the forum and sat through all of the sessions, that most of the participants in the forum last June was when the main public sessions were held in June 2011. Most participants agreed with this general aim. However, there was also significant disagreement on some issues that arise in trying to achieve this aim, and I'd like to reflect on some of those issues with you now. In other words, I'm deliberately drawing to your attention where there's division of opinion. On a lot of issues here, there is agreement. For instance, there is agreement on the principle that the Irish primary school system should have greater diversity of provision. I meet no one anywhere in the country who says to me that we should have more Catholic schools. We should increase the number from roughly 89-88%. The vast majority of people agree, quite rationally, I think, that in a change in society, one could imagine that there would be less Catholic schools. But there is then a fundamental disagreement on how you would get to that point, and we're waiting for the final report on the forum to give us maybe some guidelines or even a roadmap to reflect further on that. The first issue I want to draw to your attention is the one I mentioned already has been most important, and that is, what is the meaning, or what would be your views, concerning pluralism and the freedom of religion? Freedom of religion, remember, is part of the bedrock upon which all Western democracies are constructed. Freedom of religion is an absolutely central tenet in all key Western democracies, and it finds succinct expression and support in Article 44 of our Irish Constitution. So Ireland is committed under its constitution and its laws and its governmental structure to the freedom of religion. The question, of course, is, what is freedom of religion? And there is undoubtedly a fear amongst a lot of religious believers that this is a one-sided argument. And I want to read you a substantial quote, so just bear with me for a moment. This is a reference from a text submitted by the Council for Education of the Irish Bishops' Conference last June, to the Universal Periodic Review of the UN Human Rights Council. So the UN Human Rights Council these days, actually, there's still discussion going on about this. All of the UN members review their peers, that's other countries, and Ireland came up for review in the course of the last year. And this was what the Irish Bishops' Conference had to say about freedom of religion. And I quote, "The legally recognised human right to refer to as freedom of religion can be thought of as comprising two distinct but equally important dimensions or moral rights. It is both a positive freedom for religion, e.g. the freedom to practice, manifest and share one's religious commitments, and a negative freedom from religious coercion. Examples, the freedom from coercion to assent to any particular religious belief or philosophical position. These two dimensions may occasionally come into tension, such that at times such balance must be struck in practice, but it is never justifiable to prefer one to the total exclusion of the other. This is because either aspect loses its justifying rationale in the absence of the other." The point being made here is that freedom of religion is a two-sided coin, and in fact, to be truly committed to this pluralist democratic principle, you must balance this right. Everyone has a right not to be exposed to religion in a way that they judge that it is not part of their life choice. And those of us who are of religious belief have a right to give expression to that religious belief, not just in private acts of prayer and worship, but in public action and public associational activity, one of which examples, of course, would be the establishment and the running of schools. If you distort the idea of, if you only have a negative notion of the freedom of religion, then words like indoctrination, proselytism and so on become the dominant lexicon, and particularly in democratic discourse those words can begin to dominate. But there was a very important judgment these very days last year. The European Court of Human Rights has given a judgment that's hugely important in looking to the future in the Laozi versus Italy case that many of you will know of, which is well known, having the symbol of the crucifix in state schools in Italy. And without going into the detail of the case, there's hugely significant jurisprudence behind this case, because the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights, which is with 17 judges, voted 15-2 to reverse the judgment of the lower court, which had found that Italy was breaching the human rights of the applicant who brought the case against the Italian Republic. This was a huge turnaround in a judgment, and the discourse as enunciated by the European Court gave very strong affirmation to the right of states to deal with their own education system. It's called the margin of appreciation, as they would see fit. So religious believers in many countries, and the Laozi case is a good pointer to this, are now pointing towards uses of the term pluralism that actually inhibit their profession of faith. This is a concern, as you know, and the Iona Institute has often spoken about this. Examples of this have emerged particularly in European countries where there are attempts to restrict religious dress, religious symbols, maybe even religious festivities. And some scholars, and I think this is a useful distinction, speak of a contrast between epistemological pluralism and ideological pluralism. Epistemological pluralism is the fundamental statement of a recognition of the right to existence of contradictory truth claims. So in a democracy, contradictory truth claims have a right to coexist. Think of them, they're obvious. Christianity, Islam, atheism. These are not compatible belief systems which could be easily reduced to one another. They are quite distinct and make very different claims about the very nature of human existence and its destiny. But in a plural democratic society, these must be given tolerance, all of these systems of belief. That's what true epistemological pluralism would be. Ideological pluralism, on the other hand, is the insistence that the only truth is pluralism. And a weak, woolsey truth it can be, of course, in all sorts of ways. A truly pluralist society must surely learn to live with and respect difference while fostering loyalty to the nation and support for democratic structures of government. Turning then to Catholic schools in particular, because this forms such a majority in the Irish primary school sector, though not to the same extent in the second level sector, Catholic schools and human rights is an important theme. The question of human rights in the forum last year particularly arose with regard to children whose parents wished them to opt out of religious education classes. Some commentators speak of the dangers of proselytism and indoctrination in denominational schools without, by the way, ever defining these terms. And this is one of the real problems in European discourse about proselytism and indoctrination. It's unclear what's actually exactly meant by those terms. I reject fundamentally, and did so at the forum, the claim that religious education provided in Catholic schools is indoctrination. To introduce a child to the faith of parents through the schooling system is not proselytism or indoctrination, but properly understood as education. Catholic parents have the human right to form their children in accordance with their philosophical and religious convictions. Religious education has nothing in common with indoctrination, which amounts to a deliberate harming of students by understanding their natural capacity to reason. In contrast, Catholic and other Christian schools, may I emphasize, are committed to the deepest respect for both faith and reason, and as such they contribute significantly to the formation of rational and mature citizens of our democratic society. It is, of course, clear constitutionally and in terms of legislation, Catholic schools have a responsibility to uphold the right of parents who wish on conscientious grounds for their child to opt out of any subject. Everyone always talks about it as religion, but the law actually provides that parents who on conscientious grounds object to any subject could request the school to make sure that their child was not part of that particular class. It must be noted, though, and this is a very important point, that while students can opt out of particular subjects in accordance with the law, they cannot opt out of the culture and characteristic spirit of the school, whether it is non-denominational, multi-denominational, or denominational. In all of this, of course, it should be noted that the characteristic spirit of the school is not static. Schools are living bodies, they're not dead entities, and so the characteristic spirit of a school will develop, not least as it evolves in response to social and demographic factors in the local community. Denominational schools, if they are to maintain their identity in this evolving social context, will need reasonable legislative provisions concerning enrollment, employment, and the curriculum in religious education. And these are the three things I really want to draw to your attention today: enrollment, employment, and the curriculum in religious education. Let's look at each of them in turn. Firstly, enrollment. In June of last year, of 2011, the Department of Education and Skills published a discussion paper on a regulatory framework for school enrollment. This was a very welcome development. The paper notes, and this is significant, that just 20% of schools in the Republic of Ireland are oversubscribed and therefore must use an enrollment policy to allocate places to new applicants. Thus, the vast majority of schools have the capacity to offer places to all applicants. And in fact, a lot of schools, as you know, would cut your arm off to get more students in the door. Schools are actually in competition for applicants in many communities. With regard to religious faith as a possible criterion for use in enrollment policy, in other words, you have several criteria in your enrollment policy. Can affiliation to one particular religious denomination be one of those criteria? The paper, this is the consultation paper of the department, states, and I quote, "The existing denominational school system and equality legislation supports the right of denominational schools to give priority to children of a particular faith. It is not proposed to change this." End of quote. This equality legislation is very restrictive and its practical effects are limited. Enrollment policies will usually have several criteria which are not related to religion at all. Think of age, the age of the pupil, first come, first served, siblings of current students, relatives of staff or past pupils, geographic boundaries, feeder schools, language issues in the case of Gael Scullina. These are all criteria that are used rationally by various schools in their enrollment policy. It should be noted that schools are more likely to be oversubscribed in urban areas, where alternative undersubscribed schools are often readily available nearby. Having the right to use religious faith as a criterion in enrollment is particularly important for minority faith communities, such as the Reformed churches in the Republic of Ireland. And this is a very important point, and the Bishop was talking about the huge threat, Bishop Clark, to the continuance of Church of Ireland schools given the budgetary proposals in the most recent budget. May I say, and I spoke recently at the Church of Ireland Primary School Management Association gathering in Dublin, this is a hugely significant issue, and all of the Roman Catholic community needs to become aware of this. The current threat to the future of Church of Ireland schools is serious, and they are being seriously undermined by government budgetary policy. It is in the interests of anybody who is serious about pluralism must be surely committed to the future of Church of Ireland schools, as they are the best example of a plurality of provision since the foundation of the state in 1921. I would make the claim, ultimately, that enrolment policies are a necessary element in the protection of the human rights of freedom of religion and of parental choice in education in a pluralist society. If you cannot have an enrolment policy at all, and in fairness no one is suggesting this, I don't think, but if you couldn't have any enrolment policy, then effectively the school has lost the capacity to govern itself. In regard to employment, Section 37 of the Employment Equality Act comes in for much criticism, especially from teachers' representatives. Much of this is caused, I believe, by a misinterpretation of the intention and reasoning behind this section. The Act is very wide-ranging and definitive in its demand on employers not to discriminate on any of the 9 defined grounds, including religious belief. If there were no Section 37 in the Employment Equality Act, or its equivalent, then a religious body would have no right to use religious belief and affiliation in any of its employments. And I want you to think for a moment not about schools, but about other area of religious institutional employment. Thus, a Catholic parish, a Church of Ireland diocese, a synagogue or a mosque could not use religious belief as a criterion for selecting its employees. It seems clear to most observers that this would be unconstitutional, as it would interfere with the constitutional right of religious bodies to run their own affairs, and it would undermine the human right of freedom of religion. This is probably, by the way, why the Supreme Court noted, when the Equality Employment Bill was referred to it by President Robinson back in 1997 under the prerogative of the President in the Constitution, the Supreme Court noted in its judgment that without Section 37, the bill might be unconstitutional. Most people who criticise Section 37 seem to do so on the grounds of respect for sexual orientation. This is the main issue that's raised in the current debate. But would it be legitimate for the law to accord greater individual rights in relation to sexual freedom than apply in other areas such as religious freedom? No freedom is ever absolute, as it must contend with legitimate expressions of other freedoms. This, then, is a matter of a balance of rights. With regard to schools, we should note, and many people ignore this, that the employer is the board of management. The churches are not employers of teachers. We have roughly 3,400 boards of management running schools with a religious ethos, Catholic, Church of Ireland and so on, primary and post-primary. Each one of these boards is a corporate body and it must balance all of the contesting rights legitimately present in a school. So there are roughly 27,000 persons serving on these boards of management, and they engage outside educational experts to be part of their interview panels for staff vacancies and promotions. I think that we should trust these individual boards to make reasonable judgments as to what is best for their school in their locality and to keep a balance with regard to various rights. In this regard too, in case there's any misunderstanding, maybe let me put it a bit further. I think people completely misinterpret what Section 37 is about. Section 37 was not put into the Employment Equality Act to have anything to do with sexual orientation. It was put in to deal with religious belief, that religious bodies, when they would insist in certain circumstances, it is one example, that a religious believer would be employed, a Catholic, a Church of Ireland member, a Muslim, a Jew, rather than somebody else, and that they did so in order to protect the ethos of whatever institution you're talking about, that would not amount to discrimination under the Act. If the Act was to be amended as along the lines as suggested recently, to say, for instance, that certain issues about marital status or sexual orientation would not be part of what Section 37 intended. You could do that, and that might stand. I would suggest that what will happen as a result of that is that religious bodies, bit by bit, will become much more insistent about what Section 37 is actually about, and which Irish religious institutions have never implemented, and that is the demand for religious belief. It is religious belief that is guaranteed under Section 37 as having a role in the running of religious institutions, not the other eight grounds of discrimination. So I think we need to be very careful in the reflection on Section 37. The conversation thus far is all about the rights of gay and lesbian and transgender teachers tends to dominate it at the moment. In fact, there's a whole other issue behind Section 37, which is about the rights of religious institutions to actually give life and meaning to what it is to be a religious institution. In regard to religious education, it became clear at the forum sessions in June last that all patrons want to provide some form of programme with regard to religion and ethics. This might come as news to you, by the way, but it's an interesting point. Everybody, including all of the patrons at the forum last June, agreed that in any Irish primary school there should be a programme that deals with religion and ethics. Nobody proposed a completely secular school. And when people, patrons, were asked, would they provide a secular school, purely secular, in the European sense, they said no, because there was no demand for such. Such a programme in religious education could take a phenomenological approach, as happens in many secular schools across Europe, where children are introduced to religions as one datum among many others. The phenomenological approach is useful, but is very limited from a faith-based perspective. It amounts to education about religions and beliefs rather than education into religion and from the perspective of religious faith. It's clear from Article 42 of the Constitution and from the Education Act that schools must support the moral, spiritual and religious development of the child. This amounts, I would suggest to you, to much more than a general introduction to ethics. In the Judeo-Christian thinking, of which all of our traditions are a part, informed as it is by Greek philosophy and the biblical traditions, the study of morality and ethics is not just about the provision of information. It is deeply committed to character formation and human development. It is an intentional activity which needs to articulate the skills and goals which it intends to develop and the moral literacy which it seeks to foster. The preliminary report of the forum raised questions about the integrated curriculum and Rule 68 of national schools, of the Rules of National Schools. The primary school curriculum, which was last revised in 1999, is founded on the principle of the integration of learning. I quote from the introduction to the curriculum, which was published by the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment. For the young child, the distinctions between subjects are not relevant. What is more important is that he or she experiences a coherent learning process that accommodates a variety of elements. It is important, therefore, to make connections between learning in different subjects, end of quote. And that is the foundation of the integrated curriculum. The religious education program in primary schools has been developed over many years as part of this integrated curriculum. The aim is not that all elements of the curriculum must be used for religious purposes, but that the various strands of the curriculum can inform and support each other in promoting the moral, spiritual, social and personal development of all the students in the school. The preliminary report goes on to make further specific recommendations regarding Rule 68. Now, you won't know the rules for primary school off by heart, but let me tell you that there are 165 of them. Two of them deal with religious instruction, Rules 68 and 69. Yet these are the only two you hear much about. The problem with the rules for national schools is that they need to be revised, they need to be updated. Many of them are obsolete. I mean, what would you think of the ones that deal in quite some detail with the primary cert in education, corporal punishment, of which it speaks not altogether negatively, the fact that teachers cannot own public houses, and the most striking one of all, the three or four sections on backward children. So the language, you can see, has been completely superseded. But it's interesting that all of the attention in media commentary is on Rule 68, without acknowledging the fact that the whole rule book has to be rewritten to take account of legislative changes and indeed changes in social mores and the realities of the society in which we live. Rule 68 matters. It badly needs to be rewritten in more cogent language for today. But what I would point out to you, it is one, there are only two rules of the 165 that deal with values. Tell me, who would object to the following values being communicated to their child? The teacher, I'm quoting from Rule 68, should constantly inculcate the practice of charity, justice, truth, patience, temperance, obedience to lawful authority, and all the other moral virtues. If you drop Rule 68, I want to know before you drop it what you're replacing it with. And I think parents want to know what you're replacing it with. You can read about 163 rules about teachers' salaries, all of which are now irrelevant because they've been superseded by national agreements and so on. But there are only two that deal with values, and values are key in the parental understanding of education. Rule 68 cannot simply be abandoned. It needs to be reviewed, and there needs to be a new articulation of what it intends. It's not altogether clear in what the preliminary report of the forum had to say about various issues to deal with religious education. They spoke about religious symbols, celebrations, and prayer. If it is intended that all schools should heighten their sensitivity to the presence of children of all faiths and none, then that is welcome. However, if a more syncretistic approach has been proposed, which suggests that all religions are the same, or that a school should not give expression to its identity and should reduce it to the lowest common denominator, then this would clearly undermine the characteristic spirit of the school. If that were the case, the issue of divesting schools would be largely redundant, as the denominational identity of schools would be so diluted as to be largely irrelevant. Finally, I want to draw to your attention a process for understanding, supporting, and taking ownership of the characteristic spirit in a Catholic school, which is now about to be launched by the Catholic Schools Partnership, which is the body for which I work. Given all that I've said about the whole Catholic identity of schools in a new and more plural society, we want to foster schools in reflecting on their own identity. There has been much media comment at a national level in recent years about the future of Catholic primary schools. Research undertaken by the Catholic Schools Partnership has found that those involved in schools often feel left out of these conversations, as if their voice doesn't matter. This is an unacceptable situation because nothing is more important in a local area than its schools. At four regional assemblies held by the CSP in 2011, there was strong support for continuing conversations about the future of Catholic primary schools at a more local level because people do feel left out of this conversation. So in October 2011, the CSP published the outcomes of its research, and one of the outcomes stated that we would facilitate a deeper understanding of what it is to be a Catholic school in Ireland and to prepare the way for a change in patronage where that would be appropriate. The CSP will provide schools with a dynamic self-evaluation tool. This will facilitate schools in reflecting on their identity and priorities with all of the school community, parents, pupils, staff members, members of the board and the local community. The CSP has now completed its work on this instrument and will invite schools to use it as part of a process of understanding, supporting and taking ownership of the characteristic spirit or ethos of a Catholic school. This means that the conversation which thus far has taken place only at a national level can now also be facilitated in local communities. I look forward to this process enhancing the identity of many Catholic schools. I hope that as some schools use this process, their Catholic identity will grow. What commonly emerges is that Catholic schools, not least their leaders on the ground, teachers and principals and so on, often say they know what it is to be a Catholic school, but they're very poor at articulating it. We hope to facilitate a better articulation of what it is to be a Catholic school. So I look forward to the process enhancing the identity of many of these schools and of facilitating changes in the patronage of some schools where this is appropriate. In other words, as a school looks closely and reflects closely on its identity, it might come to the view that, in fact, it is not ultimately very significant, its Catholic identity, and it might be possible to use that reflection to facilitate the possible transfer to another patron. In this way, I think this process will make an important contribution to the future of Catholic schools in our pluralist and democratic society. So I wanted to bring you up to date, therefore, on some of the issues that are still a matter of debate in terms of the forum. We await, obviously, the final report of the forum, and when it emerges, I would invite all of you to read it carefully and to please participate in the conversations that will ensue, particularly at a local level. So thank you for your attention.